It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
And we're back. New season, baby.
Hell yeah.
We were so happy with our last season. I think it went really well. Maybe it was our best season yet.
Maybe it's our best season ever, and it can only go downhill from here.
Sometimes when you know you're peaking in the middle of peaking, it's concerning. That's me right now at age 27.
Yeah. It can only get worse and worse and worse.
Being a woman in her like mid to late 20s really is being like, okay, now this is the peak. Oh, now this is the peak. Okay, now this is the peak. And then you're constantly feeling like you're not meeting the peak and that you actually suck. But then in 20, 30 years, we're going to look back and be like, wow, my life was so awesome.
Yeah, you kind of spend like most of your 20s being like, I'm not an adult yet. I'm not a grown up. I'm just a baby.
I'm not a girl.
I'm not. Yes. And then you hit your late 20s and you're like, oh, I'm my life is over and I have no value and I'm old and whatever.
So, but then I hear when you hit your early 30s, you're like, well,
the clock starts again, baby.
It's rising. Yeah, exactly. So that's us, and that's what we feel about last season. But we're hoping that this season is even better. Bigger, better. We've got guests on this season. We've got experts.
We've got good times. We're talking about art this season.
I know, which I feel like we both are quite versed in, at least.
Some of them.
Having dabbled in every art growing up and being good at like none of them.
I was definitely like, I'll try a little bit of this, try a little bit of that kind of kid. I'm not a ballerina. Didn't work out. I'm not
it didn't work out.
I'm not in an improv troupe. It didn't work out. But I'm an appreciator of the arts.
I just love that the barometer for whether or not you succeeded is whether or not you're in an improv troupe.
Well, maybe like not in the classical terms of success, but like in a kind of more meaningful way, yes.
I'll be real though, our friend Emma's in an improv troupe and she blows my mind every time we go to see her. Like it really is spectacular.
Because you know when you go see someone you know do comedy and you're like, oh god, am I gonna have to pretend to laugh? It's such a relief when you watch someone do comedy and you're like, this is actually funny.
Yeah, it's nice to know. Which I think our friends in comedy are good at what they do.
Good for you guys.
But back to us being bad at all art. Maybe we're both mediocre at every art form. Like, I can play the cello. Can I play it well? Like, absolutely not. I can dance. Can I dance well? Like, absolutely not, even though I did it for 14 years.
You can dance better than me.
That is, like, sad. That shouldn't be the test of how good I am at dancing. I dedicated 14 years to that, and my barometer is, oh, I'm better than my friends, I guess.
Well, that is a feat. You always want, like, you don't want to be an incredible dancer on the dance floor because it's like, okay, what's that about? It's a little suspicious. But if you're like a medium, just like good dancer, no one has to know you did dance for 14 years. They just have to know that like you're naturally good.
Well, unfortunately, my greatest like fantasy growing up was like, oh, and then I'm going to be forced to dance in front of all my like classmates and they're going to see how talented I am and they're going to be blown away and all the boys are going to fall in love with me. So like I do want to kind of blow.
You're only 27. There's so much time for that.
I was about to be like, I do really want to blow ass on the dance floor.
There's so much time for that too.
Incontinence is the fantasy. Anyways, so we're excited to be back. We're gonna keep this intro short because we want to get started. So let's get into it. I'm Maya.
And I'm Hannah.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about when art meets the internet. Is the sun rising on a new creative era, or did it set before it even began? We workshopped this slogan for a while. We don't know if it makes sense grammatically, but you're just going to have to roll with it.
Deal with it, you guys.
If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. And we like to kind of fill the space in between our seasons with the best minisodes we can offer.
Yeah, if you want our takes on everything from the Drake and Kendrick beef to Sabrina Carpenter to
age gaps,
yes,
then go hit it up. If you don't want to join the Patreon for whatever reason, just kidding, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps us out so much, guys. I'm so excited because today we're going to talk about one of the most successful yet divisive poets of our time, Rupi Kaur. For those of you who don't know, Rupi Kaur is a Punjabi Canadian woman from Brampton, Ontario, which is a populous suburb of our beautiful city, Toronto, which has a large South Asian diaspora. It also happens to be where a lot of my extended family lives. Rupi's 2014 book of poetry, Milk and Honey, which has sold, at the time of this episode, about 11 million copies worldwide.
And
you'll believe it. And has been translated into 43 languages, has been credited for resuscitating poetry as an art form. And her success with Milk and Honey didn't happen in a vacuum. While she had been writing and performing poetry since 2009, Rupi came to the attention of the public when she was in university after an artful photo that she had posted on Instagram of her period-stained sweatpants was removed by the platform. Did you see it at the time?
I don't think I saw it at the time, but I remember being aware of it, like, retroactively. But also, like, yeah, 2014 really was the time of, like, if you show, like, something related to periods, like, that is, like, the peak of feminist art.
And it was the peak of feminist art for the time. Well, yeah, so this was a couple years after Petra Collins' photo of a woman's bush had been censored. So instances like this were kind of generating quite a bit of media attention after that. And Rupi's response to the censorship was discussed in several major publications. And so she started to garner a following on both Tumblr and Instagram, where she would frequently post her poetry. This is when Milk and Honey was then re-released by an official publisher, because originally it was self-published, and the rest is history. She went on to release another very successful book of poetry, which is called The Sun and Her Flowers. She's won a number of awards, and she was even named the Writer of the Decade by The New Republic. Do you want to describe Rupi Kaur's poetry for the listeners, Hannah, from what you can remember of it?
Yeah, for those who, I don't know, lived under a rock during the mid-2010s, Rupi Kaur's poetry is typically relatively short poems that are known for being kind of randomly spaced out. Like, her lines, she'll be like, there was, next line, a girl, next line, who, next line. It's really fragmented. It's short. They're kind of like things that really translate well to Instagram captions, is how I would say.
Well, that's the perfect way to put it, and we'll be definitely unraveling that concept in this episode. I'm trying to find any other way other than to say unpack, and it's so hard to find a synonym for it. But yeah, you're exactly right. They're short, they're very simplistic in their language. Yeah, very abrupt line breaks. And she also talks a lot about, like, identity and the self. So I'm never gonna fully encompass her body of work in, like, a 1 hour episode, but I'm just gonna have us take turns reading a few of her poems to give you guys a sense of them. So, Hannah, do you want to start us off with this one?
How is it so easy for you to be kind to people? He asked. Milk and honey dripped from my lips as I answered, because people have not been kind to me.
Here's another one. I am water, soft enough to offer life, tough enough to drown it away. Here's the next one.
It was when I stopped searching for home within others and lifted the foundations of home within myself, I found there were no roots more intimate than those between a mind and a body, and have decided to be whole.
And there's like a little illustration under all of these. So like this one has an illustration of a person with like vines going up their body, and they're holding flowers and a bird, and they're sitting in like a lotus position. I'll have you do this one, and then I'll read a bit of a longer one at the end.
You might not have been my first love, but you were the love that made all the other loves irrelevant.
And that one has like different phases of the moon illustrations. This one's going to be a bit of a longer one, but I wanted to read it out because I think, you know, we often focus on like her more zippy poetry that's on the internet, but like she does have longer poems within her books. So this one, it's just like a part of a page, but it's being the loudest on Earth's playground doesn't make us any more important than the dirt we crush beneath our feet. We are nothing except air and fire and water and soil. We are a people who forget that we are made of, a people who talk about the weather as if it's mundane and not magic, as if the oceans are not holy water, as if the sky is not a vision, as if the animals are not our siblings, as if nature is not God, and rain is not God's tears, and we are not God's children, as if God is not the earth itself. What do you think of her poetry? Like, what do you think of the poems we just read, Hannah?
I mean, I think there's sort of a spectrum within the ones we've read. You know, that most recent one, I'm not an expert on poetry. I think it's well written enough. I think it's interesting. I think the one I just read about make the loves irrelevant thing, I mean, that is something that would just be put on like a greeting card. It feels like a Taylor Swift lyric.
Well, who you love.
Right, but who I'm not about to like call, like I think she can sometimes write good lyrics, but also like I'm not saying she's a poet per se. Yeah, I don't know. I think there's sort of a spectrum there. I think some of it is like the first one I read didn't really make sense to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a little bit of that. There's a lot of things that sound pretty, but I don't really know what she's trying to articulate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bit of a mixed bunch.
Do you think if you like sat down with it a bit longer, you'd get to the bottom of it? Or do you think it just is a little bit unintelligible?
Well, okay, so that first one, it just kind of reminds me of like the kind of things that would get copy and pasted on Facebook or something.
Yeah.
Like, or early Tumblr sentiments that it just feels like it was maybe written by like a 12-year-old.
And what's hard to kind of decipher, which we'll kind of be like grappling with in this episode, is, oh, whether or not we're so tired of this type of poetry at this day and time that we roll our eyes immediately at it, and whether or not back in 2014 we would have maybe read this or stumbled upon it and been like, wow. It's always hard for me to know how much of it is like my cynicism. Yeah, I think what I notice immediately about Ruby's poetry is that it's very warm, and like that's something I appreciate about it. Like it often fills you with like a warm feeling. Not all of her poems are like happy. She does talk about sexual assault in some of her poems. Some of them do deal with heavier topics, but for the most part, like I find it to be kind of like a warm, kind of like feel good poetry almost, is how I would describe it.
Yeah, it's sort of like poetry you read on your self-care day.
Yeah, like I need an affirmation kind of vibe.
I got
yeah.
My like matcha latte and my poetry book.
My matcha. So you're not the only one to have taken issues with Rupi's work. We'll get into the weeds of these criticisms later, but like essentially there's been a lot of debate both within and outside of the poetry community about the merits of her poems and the reasons that she's become so successful. I actually had a debate with my friends a couple years ago because I do this really annoying thing that Hannah is well aware of, where I'll speak in like hyperbole just to annoy people and then get annoyed when they don't agree with me. And this is one of the things. So I went around being like, I think poetry's dead, and then kind of wait and see what people would say.
It's really funny because she's like being a shit disturber, but then she's so competitive that she gets emotionally invested in it.
Or it's this like, happened to me with Nickelback. I was like, Nickelback's a great band. I still think that, but...
And I respect you as a person.
Yeah, thank you so much. I just don't understand why people have to be such haters. Like, they're fine. Leave them alone. Leave Nickelback alone. But yeah, so I was like, poetry's dead. And then my friends immediately were like, what are you talking about? That's so incorrect. I don't even fully believe that, but sometimes it's just fun to say it. I know you don't. Like, I like poetry. I wrote it a lot as a teenager. Like, I'm kind of not in touch with that side of myself anymore. But like, it's something I was really engaged with when I was young. I was really into slam poetry in middle school. I performed a few times.
Could you just give us a little bit of that?
Yeah, so then we had this heated back and forth, and basically immediately my friends were like, what about Rupi Kaur, though? Like, how can you say poetry's dead when Rupi Kaur is so famous and so successful? And I was like, oh, like, personally, and I'll state my bias at the beginning of this episode. Like, I am not a Rupi Kaur fan. Am I a hater? No, but I'm not a fan of her at all. So I was kind of like, I don't know if that's like the best example. And they were like, well, she did make poetry for everyone. So her contribution to the art form is just worthy of praise and inherently suggests that like poetry is alive and well. This is something that I kind of want to drive the episode with. So the most common points people make when they defend Ruby Kaur are these. I just want to go through them a bit. That a large amount of criticism thrown her way is coming from a place of misogyny. Like how when people immediately like eye roll at anything that women like Taylor Swift or boy bands or like makeup, I don't know. Ruby's poetry is like obviously super resonant with young women and it makes them feel seen. So you could imagine that this makes sense. Another defense is that when people say they dislike Ruby Kaur, it's coming from a place of racism. The argument usually goes that there's like a lot of barriers to entry for people of color and especially women of color when it comes to the world of poetry. And that Instagram allows people to bypass those barriers by like gaining popularity organically. So it can feel maybe sometimes a bit pointed to hate the work of poets who are mostly popular online since so many of them are marginalized and people of color. And then the last major defense is that criticisms of Ruby Kaur are elitist. There's this article in The Guardian that came out this year by a writer named Miski Omar, who talks about how she went through this period of disliking Ruby Kaur, like everyone else did, but then recently decided to embrace her again after reading this Audre Lorde essay called Poetry is Not a Luxury. And basically in this essay, Lorde talks about how poetry is essentially something that's like innate within women, just like waiting to come out, but it's something that is sitting within us. And Omar pulls from this quote where Lorde says, "For women, poetry is not a luxury. It is a vital necessity of our existence. It forms the quality of the light within which we predicate our hopes and dreams towards survival and change, first made into language, then into idea, then into more tangible action." And Omar takes that quote and basically comes to the conclusion that, like, art should be accessible to all, like, because art is within us all. So basically the same reasoning my friends had, like, Ruby Kaur's poetry is inherently good because it's available to everyone and it's easy for everyone to understand. What do you think of this, like, maxim that art should be accessible to all?
I think as far as, like, barriers to entry as creators or consumers of art, I do believe if we maintained, like, such strict barriers, we would have actually, like, lost and, like, missed a lot of incredible artists in the span of human history. And I'm sure that there are so many incredible voices and, like, creatives that never got their time in the sun because of those barriers to entry. And like, I do think that when we talk about like kind of democratizing forces in art, like it can be an exciting prospect to think about like the kind of unsung people that will get that opportunity. But then I also think that unfortunately, like the most democratizing force in art for us right now is social media. And I would say social media is not actually as democratic as we think it is, or like it is, but it's also like so based in capitalism and so based in like, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. Maybe I'm not directly answering your question, but no, I would say like Ruby Kaur, her poetry, the form of it and the simplicity of it makes it accessible to more people. It makes it easier to sell. It makes it easier to put on things. It's like a much more commercially accessible piece of work. And like it's much more amped for like commercialization than perhaps other art, especially within poetry. I do think that ultimately, if somebody gets something out of a piece of work, I am not here to tell them that like whatever feelings it's evoking aren't valid and that they don't get to like relate to something or experience something. But I do think that we need to also encourage a spectrum of accessibility and also not make it harder for people to make things that are a little bit more out there, that are a little bit less of the norm, and that gives people the chance to enjoy that work and find that work and like expand their horizons.
No, I think that's exactly it. I think when we think about art should be accessible, we're not really thinking about both sides. Like it, yes, should be accessible to people on the side of creation and like making art and like getting rid of barriers to entry and making sure that everyone's voice is heard, making sure that not only people who come up through the institution are the ones getting success, like all this stuff. But then on the other side, like when we talk about art being accessible, we don't seem to have a definition of what accessibility means in terms of like the consumption of art. I think for me, like it kind of places this onus upon art that doesn't necessarily like need to be there. just because it is a maxim, like, it's just this, like, one statement, like, art should be accessible without really interrogating what that means. Like, yes, when art is available and accessible to the public, it's obviously a good thing, but people should be able to experience art regardless of, like, their financial background, their identity, whatever. But I think when people say this, it's, like, one, making it sound like the sole purpose of art is to be consumed by, like, the masses. And then two, it kind of, like, steamrolls criticisms of the quality of a work by insinuating that, like, anyone who criticizes that work is elitist. Because, like, well, it's accessible, so why are you criticizing it? Like, at least someone's enjoying it. And, like, I completely agree. I think if someone gets enjoyment out of a certain piece of work, that's amazing. And, like, I think Rupi Kaur has resonated with a lot of people and, like I said, has made them feel seen, made them feel comforted. That's amazing. And, like, it's important that her work is resonant. But that doesn't mean that people who are critical of it are inherently being elitist. We'll get into, like, assessments of Rupi's poems, but I think a lot of people conflate, like, simplistic language with accessibility, which kind of tends to neglect a lot of what goes on in a poem, both on the part of the poet and the reader. Like, yes, the language of poetry can be, I guess, inaccessible, but, like, a lot of the time the conventions of a poem, like metaphor, for example, aren't actually there to confuse you. Like, they're meant to broaden your interpretation of a work. So, like, anyone who can read can ostensibly read a poem and, like, maybe just sit with it for a longer period of time and think about what it means to them. There is no right or wrong reading of a poem, right? Whereas, like, Rupi doesn't often use these conventions, and so many of her poems are just interpreted for you within the writing, and I think that that's worthy of criticism. And I don't think that that necessarily, I don't think a poem that's, like, challenging you, which we'll talk about, is actually necessarily inaccessible. It's just challenging, you know? So these criticisms and defenses of poetry, like, aren't new. For example, when slam poetry came up in the mid-80s, there were tons of, like, establishment poets who were just, like, these old fuddy-duddy white guys who basically wrote it off completely. Like, there was this one article in this 2000 issue of the Paris Review called "The Man in the Back Row Has a Question," where this literary critic, Harold Bloom, said that slam poetry was the death of art. He had this quote where he was like, "Various young men and women in various late spots are declaiming rant and nonsense at each other. The whole thing is judged by an applause meter, which is actually not there, but it may as well be." Are you familiar with slam poetry? Did you ever watch it?
Not really. I think, unfortunately, like, a lot of my knowledge of slam is through mockery of slam poetry. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, I think, like, anything that's so popular, same thing as Rupi Kaur's, right? Like, it's going to be very easily parodied. So I think slam poetry, yeah, like, has been mocked in popular culture. But for people who don't know the history, slam poetry is, like, traditionally a competition form of poetry, performance poetry, where poets will basically orate their poems, and then they'll be judged by 5 randomly selected audience members based on a rubric of a score out of 10. And there's this book I was reading by a writer named Javon Johnson called "Killing Poetry, Blackness, and the Making of Slam and Spoken Word Communities." And he basically draws a link between Black artists of the Harlem Renaissance, and then he draws it to rap, and then he draws it to slam poetry, which came about in Chicago. And he talks about how Black artists, like, within these art forms were rejecting a white gaze, which made their crafts, you know, very subject to criticism and, like, dismissal by the establishment. And Johnson says that while slam poetry and spoken word aren't entirely or, like, historically Black, he says that, quote, "they too are always searching for and working towards something beyond, often by working in these radical traditions." It has very anti-elitist origins in a similar way that Rupi Kaur does or purports to have. Like, there was this 1986 article where this woman interviews the creator of slam poetry named Mark Smith, and he's, like, super anti-establishment, whatever. And then the author concludes that poetry readings have always smacked of snobbery. Too often, intellectual posers sniff through readings of obscure scribblings while jaded members of the sparse audience nod their heads in subdued agreement. It's not exactly a happening scene. So you can kind of obviously see similarities between, you know, Rupi and these kinds of newer forms of poetry. Like, you have this refusal of the white gaze. Whenever she's kind of responding to criticism, she'll be like, "This is not for you, though. This is for that little brown girl in Brampton." Like, whenever the establishment criticizes her. And then you have, like, the anti-elitism stuff. She's kind of positioned against the, like, stuffy, inaccessible academic poetry. And she's, like, the poetry of the masses, you know, poetry for the people. But do you think that there are any, like, key differences between Rupi and slam poetry, just based on what I've described, even?
Well, like, when I, and maybe I'm wrong, but when I think about slam poetry, I'm thinking about people in, like, a coffee house performing their work for a community of other like-minded people. It's from the 80s. I kind of associate it a bit with the 90s in my brain. I think
maybe... I'm sure it got popular in the 90s.
Yeah, and I think the kind of idea of like, it's non-commercial. It's not about selling out. It's about expressing feelings. It's like the difference is that like Rupee Kaur is making stuff that's supposed to be consumed by the most amount of people at once. Mm-hmm. Like her stuff is posted to social media and sold by the millions. Mm-hmm. And I think that even just there, that's a pretty tangible difference. And then like the actual work itself, I think slam poetry sounds like it's supposed to be like a performance art. So it feels different from like a little bit of text on a white page.
No, that's exactly it. Slam poetry has been compared to like radical theater because it'll kind of come up in these organic spaces. Yeah, like you're saying, a coffee shop, a record store, like a bookstore. So it's inherently kind of community based and like you're saying, non-commercial. And like a lot of people's knowledge of slam poetry comes from Russell Simmons' Deaf Poetry TV show, which I was like obsessed with in middle school. But that was actually really criticized by the slam community because they were like, oh, you're selling out, you're commercializing our art form. Whereas, so Rupee has participated in like versions of performance poetry. She was running that circuit before she got famous, but like her written work, and this is probably one of the strongest criticisms of it, is very commercial. And for that reason, you know, as much as she says that her work is like refusing a gaze and rejecting an establishment, it might actually be doing the opposite, which is what the crux of what we're going to be talking about today is. So there are two very damning articles that were written about Rupee Kaur and other poets like her, which came out in the last few years. The first was like very, very controversial within the poetry community and even outside of it. Like it made news headlines. And the other was less controversial. But I want to discuss them because I think they bring up really interesting issues with what's happening to poetry as an art form. So the first one's called The Cult of the Noble Amateur, which is this polemic by Rebecca Watts for the PN Review back in 2018. And it's like fucking scathing. She basically talks about like a number of poets, which include like, you know, Rupee Kaur, Kate Tempest, but the poet she hones in on mostly is Holly McNish, who's this English poet. And she, in the review, she's talking about Holly's most recent book at the time, which was Plum. And Watts says that she isn't even willing to give this type of poetry a review because she doesn't think it qualifies as poetry.
Ooh.
Very controversial. So I'm going to say off the bat that Watts can be like very out of pocket in this review. I kept kind of like gasping while I was reading it. And she doesn't really help herself much in terms of like proving people wrong about the poetry establishment. She'll like, for example, only bring up, you know, young female poets as examples of what's wrong with poetry, where there are like many male poets who are super famous on Instagram and social media. She also sometimes speaks in language that like, when I don't think it's actually malintentioned, it can be kind of coded. Like at one point she's like wondering what a good flourishing poetry market is if we're only reading books that make us less appreciative of nuance. And she goes on to say, more indignant about the things that annoy us and more resentful of others who appear different from us. Which like, I don't think she's trying to sound racist here, but I think the language can, you know, be read in a certain way. She also doesn't really beat the elitism allegations. When she's talking about Holly's book, she says, I keep reminding myself of the facts. This is published by Picador. Don Patterson edited it. The books cost $9.99. So we can see like why the review generated the backlash that it did. But I also felt like a lot of the points she made are worth discussing. And I kind of like appreciated her no-nonsense anger in this. She herself is a poet, and I think it's just, it was written from a place of frustration. So I'm going to have us read some of Holly McNish's poems, because a lot of people were upset that she was compared to Rupee Kaur, since her work tends to be like a bit wider in scope and like spreads across many platforms and mediums. But I do kind of understand, just like based off the work I have read, why someone might compare them. Again, like bear in mind, we cannot capture the entirety of her work from a few poems, but here are the ones I picked out. This one's called Bums. People talking every day about the topic of the year. Is it fun to shake about or just a thing for us to jeer at? Have I seen the videos? Do I think that they're okay? People asking me about bums every day. Anaconda bums from Nicki Minaj. Kim Kardashian's new photo shoot. Is it racist? Is it class? J-Lo's and Iggy's latest dance. Pretending to be lesbians. Female bums, oiled and greased. More striptease for MTV. Is J-Lo's bum too old, we cry? Is Iggy's bum too white? But J-Lo's 43, they say, as we slag her off all night. Then Meghan Trainor steps up and it's all about that bass again. And the beats are so damn good and the lyrics stick inside your head. Conversations start again, fleshy bits are better. Her mom says men don't like it thin. questions, comments flooding in. Is it all about the bass? Is it all about the bass? Can Miley Cyrus twerk? Has that girl got no damn taste? Every day I get the same discussions bouncing in my face. Is it female liberation to dance the way you want? Or is it corporate US making money selling women's bodies? Is it wrong? Is it positive for girls with bigger bums? Is it just a bit of fun? Is it fair? Is it fair? It goes on for a while, but that's kind of the gist of that poem. Hannah, I'll have you read this one.
I want to spoon you and watch Star Wars tonight. Today has been a long day. That's how the saying goes. I do not want to talk. I do not want us wearing clothes. I want to be the front spoon, lamp off, duvet up, Yoda and spaceship race, some kisses on the nubbin at the bottom of your neck, your crotch nudging my buttocks with the hint of maybe sex, warm semi on my backbone, arm loped across my chest. I want a second chance for Anakin. That mask still makes me weep. I want a fondle of at least one breast, then silently to sleep.
I love how Canadian you were just saying semi like that.
What am I supposed to say? Semi?
Yeah, semi.
Is that Canadian?
I don't know. I was wondering. This one's called Belly. I tell myself over and over again to be proud. Look down. That space was a house. Heated perfectly with blood and food, tubed through an open belly button, it grew. But some days I still can't help staring. Some days I still can't help frowning at the softness, testing it with pokes, slapping myself for feeling that this lack of tighter muscles is still sometimes, on tired days, bad. My belly raised a life. Why can't I focus on that? We'll keep it to those three. What are your initial takeaways from these poems? Like, can you describe her style? Like, how does it kind of compare to Rupee's?
Well, so I think especially with the first two, like the constant reference to like popular culture, I think can be a tough thing to incorporate into something like poetry, perhaps, because and I'm like trying to not make it be like that bias against like your like popular culture, low culture, mm-hmm. suddenly cheapen something. But mm-hmm. I think for the one about bums,
which is from 2014,
that was the topic of conversation. I think bringing up all about that bass and being like, and the lyrics are so catchy and good. I'm like, okay, girl, I'm skeptical of your judgment, but I wish I had the language to articulate like what's not working a bit better. But I would say like, I think mundanity can be really interesting. I think it can be a really interesting thing to explore with. I think talking about like, you know, what's going on right now, or talking about something as simple as like watching TV with your partner, like that can be made into something interesting. Mm-hmm. But when it's the mundane and it's just like packaged as what it is, and mm-hmm. there's not really much being done to sort of make it poetic, to sort of make it something more interesting than just like writing like a list of actions or facts, I don't really know the point of it.
I was talking to a friend recently who was talking about how he was like, what is up with this trend of people just listing things in their writing? And I thought that was interesting, like listing things that are kind of for nostalgic purposes. This is not in relation to Holly McNish, but yeah, that's interesting that you brought up the list. And I think not having the language to articulate that is a great point. Watts does like a lot of breaking down of Holly's poems, and she mainly takes issue with what she sees to be like her overly simplistic language, and she says she has this like frequent use of expletives that aren't necessarily like don't always have meaning or like pack a punch because they're so frequent.
Oh, that's a big qualm I have with
that's
writing.
Hannah's big qualm, and then like her lack of metaphors and like her very literal language. She also talks about kind of like a lack of inquiry into the themes that Holly will bring up. Like here she says she's kind of going in and out of speaking and then quoting McNish, but she says, McNish is philosophizing, and I wonder why we're here, and I wonder what the point is, and what the fuck we're on this rock for, leads her simply to remind myself this is not all about you, Holly. Unfortunately, the thought, like a tweet, is no sooner expressed than forgotten. Like, she'll kind of raise these ideas but never actually follow through with them. And so, back to your point about not being able to articulate what exactly is wrong with them, neither of us are like really poets, and so I also had trouble articulating that. So for this episode, I brought in my friend Phoebe, who is a poet, and she's currently doing a poetry MFA, to give us the perspective of someone who is like engaged within the poetry community and who writes poetry herself. And I think she brought some really great like technical insights about this type of poetry that I think are really helpful when we're like assessing it as art or like trying to articulate why maybe we don't think it measures up to maybe the poetry that we like. So here's Phoebe now. Welcome, Phoebe, to the podcast. We've been trying to get Phoebe on Rehash for actually a while now. Like, there's been a couple episodes where we've been like, Phoebe, want to come on and talk about this? And you've been like, no, not that one. And this is one that you're indeed an expert in. I go to Phoebe for any tea about the literary and poetry world. So here she is. Here she is.
So to here I am. I'm not trying to reject you when I say no. I just am so scared of not being an expert on something because I feel like everyone just runs their mouth about anything these days. But
oh yeah, yeah. I should do that more often. Probably is to say no to certain things when I'm like, people will ask me to do things and I'm like, no, that has nothing to do with my field of knowledge. But
I think it's also just like having been, you get that, like being in grad school, you're in this like such insular world and you're like, I don't want to publish anything. I don't want to talk to anyone. I've like put myself in a little box for the past 2 years.
And sometimes the box is where the best minds are formed.
Yes, exactly.
So I guess, do you want to introduce yourself for the audience and just give a little about who you are, what you do?
Yeah.
Your vibe.
My name is Phoebe. I am a poet, writer. I just graduated from Brooklyn College where I got my MFA. I continue to teach English composition there. I'm also the current editor-in-chief of the Brooklyn Review and poetry editor. And I also wait tables. Like, I'm just around the world doing...
She's a single mom who works two jobs.
Exactly. I had a dream. I went to a Shania Twain concert the other night. I know it's not the artist, but that was my dream I had.
And some might say Shania Twain is the real poet here.
Yeah, she's the only living poet left.
I just wanted to ask first if you could speak a bit about your process as a poet and like how you go about conceiving of your poems, constructing them. I just want the listeners to kind of get a sense of what goes into writing poetry if they don't do it themselves.
It's changed a lot for me. My process in the past few years, I think as I've begun to work on like a longer manuscript and a book, I'm thinking more about like a poem like this needs to go here, or like this piece needs four more. I need to like accompany and match things. When it comes to writing like individual poems, every teacher I've ever had has been like, don't start with an idea of what you want the poem to be. And yet that's how I start writing every poem in a way. Like I feel like I wouldn't call myself a notes app poet by any means, but like my notes app is like, write poem about Croquembouche incident, or like write poem about Love Island, or whatever I end up writing about. Or it'll come up with like a phrase or a couplet and then sort of build off of that. But I think more than anything, my process is more about just like radical revision and continuing to come back to stuff and deciding of like, okay, does this need to be in tercets or couplets, or do I want to make this a prose block? Do I want to use the infinitive a lot? Do I want to take out all I statements? Like, it comes from really sort of precise syntactic revisions. And then out of that will come like word choice of being like, oh, I say like giggling here, but like maybe I'll change it to like changing verbs or adjectives. Like, it really goes into like that very sort of like, I don't really want to use the word surgical, but I guess sort of that's my revision process. And then when working on like a larger thing, it's a lot of like, oh, I've mentioned this too many times. Like, I need to take out all of the like times I use lilac or whatever. I think just like rigorous revision is like my process, I would say. And I also read everything while I write too, like out loud, like a crazy person.
Would you say there's kind of like a formalistic element to the art form and to like the process of creating this kind of art?
I think that I'm between two camps. Like, I definitely have poems I've written in one sitting, but I don't have any poems that have not been revised in any way, shape, or form. But also, I'm not someone who ever sets out to like write a sonnet or like be like, oh, I'm writing in like a super syllabic, metrical, like medieval form. Like, that's not my vibe. But sometimes I'll have a poem and be like, oh, this could be a sonnet, or like this is close to this thing, and what does it mean to engage with a canonical form in this way if I feel like I'm approaching it from a different angle? It really, I think it depends on the person, it depends on the poet, but I don't think I've ever read a poem that wasn't revised at all, or like really just quote unquote came from the heart, that was a particularly compelling poem, but I think any good poem has a sense of emotional urgency to it.
What do you think comprises like a good poem for you?
I think, yeah, emotional urgency, like that there, it feels as though this thing is coming from someone with some kind of lived experience, or even like an entity with like as a lived experience. Like, I think you could write an interesting poem from the perspective of like a golden retriever. Like, who fucking knows? Like, you can write a poem like voiced by anything, but that there's some sort of like kinetic emotional impetus behind the piece itself. And that then my other factor would be that there's something interesting happening with language. And that interesting thing doesn't have to be like super ornate or metrical or, you know, formalized. Like, I think there are tons of poets who are writing in really like conventional language, but are doing something interesting with that conventional language. And that conventional language is like directly engaging with or interrogating the system it's up against. But as long as you're engaging with language in a way that's like slightly off kilter, or like syntax in a way where like tense is messed with or perspective is, like as long as there's something interesting happening with language and that there's a sense of emotional urgency and then also like possibility, like that something, it's both like very possible in our lived world, but also completely sort of like intangible. Like poetry can like really do that in a way that fiction can't. It's almost like animation versus like traditional narrative film. I think that like if you're gonna make that comment, like that comparison.
Are you familiar with Ruby Kaur? And if so, what is your like relationship to her work? Like, what do you think of it?
We were talking about this off the record, my relationship to Ruby Kaur. And I don't really have a relationship to her. I think like the first instance is like resentment, honestly. It's like this idea that sort of like this very public figure where like most of her identity feels sort of disconnected from her actual work. Like her identity in the public sphere as an artist like has very little to do with the content of her work. It's like she's playing to like stadiums and she's on talk shows, and it's all very much about her as an individual and not so much about the content of the poems themselves. So I think that it's like, if I want to talk about Rupi's poems versus like her as an entity, like that those be like two different conversations. I know more people faking her voice and cadence of like improvising one of her poems and being like, my body on the sea, yours not here, like that is what I think of, like, but that's not actually anything she's ever written. More of this like jumbled hearsay is what I think of when I think of her work. But I also think her audience is not me. Ultimately, like, it's like she's not writing for me. And I think that a lot of poets are super resentful of the fact of that, because for the most part, the majority of people who read poetry are poets themselves or students or people who are being taught poetry by a poet. And so to have someone become so famous for poetry that's and her primary audience isn't other poets is actually the most sort of like unconventional thing in the world of poetry. Sure.
Do you, like, have you read any of her poems?
Yeah. I thought they would remind me of myself when I first started writing poetry, and they don't at all. Like, it's just, she does, like, all the things that, you know, you might be told in, like, a conventional poetry classic not to do. Like, abstractions, like, the line breaks don't seem motivated by sort of anything at all. Like, there's no sort of, like, sense of enjambment in a real sense. It feels like, yeah, it's like a home good sign has been lineated. And then through her sort of public persona, thusly like politicized. And like, it seems so interesting where I'm like, oh, like my white evangelical family would have this in their like living room. And yet it's now this like emblem of like radical art for everyone.
By abstractions, what do you mean by that? An enjambment.
Oh yeah, so enjambment. And jam is just like when a line in a poem breaks. So like, you know, what we think of when we think of prosody, which is another word for poetry, is that it's in verse, which means it's in enjambed lines, versus in block form or sentences. So like the primary organizing factor of the work is lineation. And that lineation is where it's in like that break is when it's enjambed, is what you would say.
And then abstraction would be also a part of that, or is that a different?
Abstraction would just be like love, pain, like sort of these like abstract concepts that are presented in a poem. Like, for instance, like if I remember getting, you know, a note in a class or like revising someone, like a friend's work, and it's like, and I feel so full or something, and you'd be like, okay, this is too abstract. Like, I'm full of beetles. Like, that immediately makes it more interesting.
So the biggest problem for Watts, which is what guides like the tone for most of the review, is that she thinks that these poets' success is a form of populism, and she even compares it to Donald Trump, which was very controversial. But what do you think she means by that?
Well, I've had this conversation with my dad, and actually, like, in talking about populism in politics, he has a friend who is connected to politics, and he expressed how the left could always benefit from, like, articulating themselves in a more populist, quote-unquote, way, like, using more simplistic language, trying to kind of step away from the stereotypes of, like, elitism, mm-hmm. and that was something that, like, when earlier on in her career, like, AOC was doing very well, mm-hmm. which was trying to just talk to people the way that you see people on the right doing, where they're trying to relate to the everyman, they're trying to relate to the people who think that they don't belong, I think, in politics and in those discussions, or that, like, you know, it's they're not being represented, especially when, like, what they're saying is actually for the benefit of those people.
Well, yeah, exactly.
And so I think it makes sense in poetry because it's like poetry is often articulating feelings or ideas or concepts, and it's the choice of the poet how blatantly they want to express those ideas. And I think people like McNish, people like Rupi Kaur are kind of, like you said earlier, telling you the idea often at face value. You're not really being made to work for it. And I think the kind of elitism accusations that get thrown at poetry is because oftentimes poets find value in obscuring what they're trying to articulate. And, like, totally. That's sort of the point of poetry a lot of the times, mm-hmm. is to find interesting ways to articulate these things.
Yeah, totally. I think Donald Trump, you know, and, like, any kind of populist politician will speak the language of the masses in service of the wealthy, in service of the establishment, but manage to kind of conceal it with the simplistic language.
And also it's like people like him because he says what he means. Like,
oh, yeah.
Quote unquote, he's always lying.
Well, but totally.
They're like, he puts it as it is. And that's
positioning yourself as the everyman when in fact you often are not.
And when your poem is just like, he was a guy who liked me, and that was cool, or whatever. you're just putting it as it is. You're not obscuring anything.
Well, exactly. That's basically it. Like, Watts is basically saying that, like, the success of Holly and her peers is populist because they use, again, the simplistic language to characterize themselves as, like, free-thinking outsiders and position themselves against the establishment, right? Like, the way that Donald Trump is positioning himself against the establishment. And also she says that the poetry establishment has also kind of made them into these populist figures by ignoring the technical merits of their work to focus instead on, like, how honest it is. Like, these women have gotten a lot of praise for their work, even from the establishment, but it always, she'll go through different, like, reviews, but it's always talking about how, like, honest and, like, raw it is. And she argues that in doing so, they're alienating, quote, poetry's natural, intelligent, and literate constituency by infantilizing our art. And here's where she makes one of her most interesting points, and this is something I think about, like, all the time. She says, they are pandering to a strain of inverse snobbery that considers talent to be undemocratic. In acting thus, they are playing a part in the establishment's muddle-headed conspiracy to democratize poetry. I just wanted to ask what you thought of this concept of, like, talent being undemocratic. Like, someone has talent and skill, and therefore it's, like, gatekeepy. Like, she's kind of putting those two things together, and then she's basically insinuating that, like, a lack of talent is populist and for the masses, which I thought was scathing but interesting.
Well, I would say, like, awarding things based on merit is meritocracy, not democracy. And so, yes, if we are giving opportunities to people based solely on their skill, then that's not, by definition, like, democratic. Mm-hmm. It's not what people are electing for. Like I just articulated, you know, a lot of people, especially with something like poetry, don't necessarily feel that they know how to assess the merit of someone's work in that way. And I think are then judging it off of a different metric than, say, someone well-versed in poetry would, right? Instead of judging it based off of like their use of language, their metaphors, their all the things that you would take into consideration if you know how to read poetry. You're like judging it based off of, does that speak to me? Is that resonant? And I think it's just by nature not democratic to award people based off of skill.
I think poetry, yeah, it's just like, it can be like a very weedy art form. And so I think people feel just like immediately, because they don't get it in an immediate basis, they kind of feel a frustration with it and like kind of write it off as something they don't want to even touch because they don't get it. You know what I mean? And I think that that's fair. I do smell like whiffs of anti-intellectualism, though, when people call poetry elitist. Like, yes, I think barriers to entry and like the institution are elitist and gatekeepy, but I don't think that a richly crafted poem with sometimes difficult vocabulary is inherently elitist. Like, I just do think it does kind of diminish poetry as a craft a bit. For me, it's like art being accessible as in, oh, like a museum or gallery has lower admission or like free admission, or like, oh, a book of poetry is affordable to buy or school is more affordable to attend. That shouldn't be the same to me as like, oh, art is easy, you know? Like, I don't think that that necessarily is the same as accessible.
I wouldn't disagree that there is an element of both populism and like, you know, anti-intellectualism, like knows no party lines. And I think that we, you know, it's so closely associated, especially in the US with like Trump and book banning. And like, we think of anti-intellectualism, like you know, when you're having a conversation about that, the person who's sort of vilifying that is usually like, you know, a New York Timesy neoliberal, like that's sort of the person who's like, you know, no one reads anymore, like no one reads Milton anymore. But I think that it actually is much more sort of muddy than that when we think about, you know, accessibility and who wants to read what. I mean, I even think about myself as a reader, like I love Sally Rooney, and a lot of my more like literati cool girlfriends would be critical of me for that. But like, I'm like, I love an accessible novel. Like I love a beach read. I think it's good that anyone's reading anything ultimately, but I think that like these internet poets are very purposefully anti-intellectual. And I wish there was just more ownership of that. I think that it's not necessarily, you know, a negative thing to like, to do that, but to not own it is sort of ridiculous to me.
Yeah, and it's so wrapped up in their branding, and like it helps them sell novels. And so it's like, okay, you're simultaneously saying that you're like anti-establishment, you're anti this, you're anti that, but then you're also making the most money out of anyone in that establishment.
Yes.
So like, yeah. How anti-establishment are you?
Well, that's the thing that I just like find sort of like rich, to be honest. It's like you're saying that you're doing this major takedown of this institution, and these institutions, like academia is struggling so much right now. Like, I think about this a lot. It's like, I'm a fucking college professor, and technically if I break down my hours, make like $7 an hour teaching. Like, it's ridiculous. And so this idea that you're taking down this evil institution, whereas like education's really important and it's really undervalued right now. And it makes me devastated. I think that every institution right now needs an element of change. And I think those changes are good, but to sort of like do away with it. Like, I notice it so much in my students where they're like, college is so dumb.
How much do you think education in poetry and like learning the skill is integral to the art form itself? Like, do you think that someone could not go to school at all and write like a well-crafted poem?
So I think that training for poetry is ridiculous. Like, it's inherently like a ginormous privilege to dedicate, you know, like I've spent 6 years studying this. That is such a luxury that I'm eternally grateful for. But I think there needs to be a larger integration of poetry in more aspects of education. I think that we should be teaching poetry in other kinds of classrooms because it's actually really accessible. Like I taught an Ocean Vuong poem that is about the Vietnam War, and we had like, and it uses lines from White Christmas in it. It's available online. You can maybe link it, but it was amazing for students who like don't have as much of a frame of reference for this historical event to get a very distilled interaction with this that's like a page and a half long and was more valuable to them than I think giving them a chapter in a history book to talk about, like, how does American pop culture figure into the experience of war in this country and our identity as like a colonial power. Like, and we could do that in a page and a half rather than like, you know, having to read five chapters from five different books. So I think it's about the integration of poetry into other classrooms because it actually is so accessible. I know you also have like a semiotics background, which I do a little bit too. And I think that poetry is a great tool for teaching like critical reading, thinking, and viewing skills in people, like because it's sort of inherent that there's going to be like some level of metaphor or like, you know, a different, you know, a quote unquote hidden meaning. But I find it really useful to teach alongside like maybe a semiotics text because it's you're exercising the same skill, which is just close reading and analysis. I think that's what's so special about poetry is that it doesn't announce itself immediately.
I was really into poetry when I was a teenager, but like obviously I've just lost my connection to a lot of art forms in my adulthood. And I'm so lame that I like went and read Daddy by Sylvia Plath just because I was like, I'm just dipping my toes back into it. Yeah. And just reading it, you know, it might not be for everyone. It's kind of controversial, but it's like, I don't know, it instills such an intense feeling in me and such like an inspired feeling. And not all the references I was aware of or like understood, but like the feeling of reading it felt so powerful. And it's such a like angry and resentful poem. And it, something about it felt extremely powerful, regardless of whether or not I understood every line to a T, you know? And I think that that's, to me, the hallmark of a good poem as well.
I think we want to understand everything. Like, I think that a real amazing pleasure happens when you put yourself in a situation that you don't fully understand or can't entirely comprehend. I'm not interested in walking through a world where I understand everything I see, because then there's no opportunity for further discovery.
Well, to what you were saying, like, I think a lot of it seems to have to do with kind of like the immediate gratification era that we're in.
I think it comes down to a bit of like some art forms more than others take time to kind of feel like you've learned the language of it, that you know how to navigate it. And they also take time to like break down an individual piece of work. And like even with something like film, sometimes I watch a film and I'm like, honestly, like, I don't have the time to, like, work for this movie. Mm-hmm. I can just admit that to myself. I think that there is room for balance in that, like, there is something that people get from poetry, they get from these things that, you know, if you're not someone who had access to the kinds of education that would, like, train your brain to want to work for those things, or you're somebody who just, you know, wants to get something out of the work without like really like submersing yourself in it, I think that like that's okay. I just think we have to be more honest with ourselves about it as a like culture.
And I don't think it necessarily has to come with just writing off the work as like, this is so pretentious, you know? Like, I just get, even with film, it's like, yeah, sometimes I don't have the time or energy to watch like a very slow cinema art house film. But that doesn't necessarily mean I think the art house film is intentionally trying to exclude me from its viewing experience. It's like, no, it just takes a bit more time. And like, I just think people get a bit insecure when they feel like they can't get something right away. And it's like, it just takes time. It takes time and it takes the effort to try and like understand it. Or you don't even have to understand every aspect of it. Like, I spoke to Phoebe about, you know, reading Sylvia Plath's poem Daddy, which is like a super famous poem. I don't understand every reference and metaphor in that poem reading it immediately, but from reading the poem, I felt like this really visceral sense of like anger coming out of her and like resentment and like hatred. And it was such a like visceral poem. It's a difficult poem. I know it's an extremely famous poem, but it is difficult. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's trying to push me away, you know what I mean? And I think I just get frustrated when people respond to things with this level of insecurity that I don't think necessarily needs to be there, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think you have to go to school to read a Sylvia Plath poem. Like, I think you can read it. If you can read, you can read a Sylvia Plath poem.
I think also sometimes it can be hard because there are works, like, and even in terms of film, talking about film, I'm like, yeah, there are sometimes where it's like something is just difficult to understand. And then there are some stuff where I'm like, oh, this actually like is someone being a pretentious knob. Like, I think I would have a harder time identifying within poetry like what is good but hard to understand and what is someone being a pretentious knob. Do you know what I mean?
I think it's like a balance, but I don't think that propping poetry up as elitist because you don't get it is fair. I think I just get frustrated with people reading art in that way and like immediately having a knee-jerk reaction because they're like defensive of their own inability to read it. It's like, just sit with it a bit. Like, sit with it. How did it make you feel? You don't have to give like an intellectual response to all art, you know. I don't think I can read most poetry and like understand everything it's trying to tell me, but I'll still sit and read with it and like just think about how it made me feel, you know what I mean?
It's also like, it's a vast art form, and yeah, like not all of it is as difficult as others.
Again, even us reading Rupi's poetry, it's like, yeah, it's too easy. Or we think it's too easy, so immediately we're kind of like, ha, like we chuckle at it. And so it's like, you know.
It's not even just that like the ideas are easy. It's just that you don't really get the sense that she's put the work into creating it. It's like, mm-hmm. It's one thing for something to be not a lot of work for the audience to understand, but it's another thing to be like, the person who made this didn't really sweat over this.
Which we'll talk about. Waltz actually says something that like challenges the idea in that Audre Lorde essay that like poetry is natural within us. She's like, when we don't expect linguistic precision from poets, perhaps it's unfair to expect it from arts editors and broadcasters. Still, people who do not know that poems are deliberately created works, not naturally occurring phenomena, should not be paid to pass judgment on and host discussions about literature. Lorde, like, obviously characterizes poetry as naturally occurring phenomena, but do you think that there's, like, space between poetry being, like, naturally occurring and being deliberately crafted art?
Well, when you had read that quote earlier, I was like, well, of course Audre Lorde thinks that poetry is, like, a naturally occurring thing because she is a poet by nature and yeah, it was naturally occurring to her. I think this is kind of a constant thing with the arts, is that like we have the people who, you know, you hear about Picasso learning to paint something perfectly before he can learn to do his more abstract work. You know, he's mastered his craft. But then you hear about people who haven't necessarily had the like full spectrum of like mastery, but are still able to make work and it comes more naturally to them, and they just kind of pick up a paintbrush and they go do 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 do.
I think about those kind of like genius musicians who are like, who like busk on the street and have never, yeah, had school training, but they just feel it, you know.
My parents, they listened to this podcast once and they love to bring it up and talk about, I wish I remember the podcast, but it basically compares Leonard Cohen and Bob Dylan. Leonard Cohen would like slave over a piece of work, took forever to write Hallelujah. It's a masterpiece.
So good.
Yeah. But that was his approach. It would be drafts and drafts and drafts. And then you have Bob Dylan, who could kind of like write his work, incredibly influential work, but it would take him way less time. He'd kind of like write it, look it over, be like, cool, good to go. But that like their work is different. Their lyricism is different from each other. But I think that it's innate within both of them, but like they're taking different approaches.
How would you compare Rupi on the spectrum of Bob Dylan to Leonard Cohen?
Well, I don't know her writing practice, but like I would assume and hope that she's not giving it the Hallelujah treatment to write, you were the guy that made me realize that all the other guys I liked, I didn't like, or whatever. I would assume that it was more on the Bob Dylan side of things. I think a lot of it goes into like, yeah, is talent innate, or is talent something you learn? Is talent something you hone, or is it just something, you know, does art just come out of you? And I think there are people I see and they obviously have improved over the years, but like there is something within them. There is, mm-hmm, an innate ability and they like you can't necessarily articulate it. And yeah, and then there are people who really dedicate to their craft. And I guess what I'm just trying to say is like you see both of those things exist in nature. And I don't really think that it's like a one or the other situation.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's so hard to measure with Rupi. Or it's been so difficult to kind of even discuss her work because it's like it's so hard to measure the merits of that in that regard. So in the next article we'll be talking about in a bit, which is called No Filter by Soraya Roberts for The Baffler, she brings up these quotes from like Oscar Wilde and T.S. Eliot, which are basically talking about how poetry isn't all that natural. Like Wilde says, all bad poetry springs from genuine feeling. To be natural is to be obvious, and to be obvious is to be inartistic. And Eliot says, the bad poet is usually unconscious where he ought to be conscious, and conscious where he ought to be unconscious. I do think this is a bit of like a masculine view of art, like kind of a positivist reading of it. I do think the poetry can be emotional and come from feeling, but I think, you know, when people like Omar defend Rupi's poetry, it also kind of like negates the detail and thought and time, like you're saying, that so many poets put into their work. And like Phoebe had said earlier, it takes her so much time to like really, like she's really thinking about the actual formalistic elements of her poems as she's writing them. It's not like she thinks that a good poem has emotional urgency to it, but she also for herself says that it takes a lot of actually breaking down and thinking about the poem. So I think, you know, that's a part of it that kind of gets left to the wayside when we talk about Rupi or when people are defending Rupi. Holly wrote a pretty hurt response to Watts, which is fair, like she was upset at the tone of Watts's article, and she goes through the piece like line by line. But even when she's defending herself, she kind of hones in on like the lack of time a lot of her poems take. Some of them are poems that, you know, she wrote as a kid and then she'll like throw it into the book. And when Watts criticizes this, she defends it by saying that like she wanted to include it because she wanted to get across how kids express themselves. And then she outright is like, not because I think those poems are great. She also refers to some of her poems as being scribbled in confused moments, but like all the while kind of failing to acknowledge that she's then like putting this stuff into a published piece of writing, and then that'll be sold to people, but not only sold to people, it's going to be subject to literary review because it's in a book. She also kind of like proves the populism point by saying that like, you know, she's not going to say her book took a long time or that she worked on it hard because, like, quote, I am not from the sort of social group where those things are said. I don't want to sound like an arrogant arsehole, and to speak about the quality of my own writing in any way other than saying I don't think it's very good is just what I'm used to. And like, yes, I think it's fair to be self-deprecating. A lot of artists think their work is crap or like they're very self-critical. But like, I just think this is like an interesting kind of false modesty when you think about the fact that her book is like selling millions of copies, or like Rupi's books are selling millions of copies. It's like, yeah, but you're still making money off this work, you know? So if you think your work is crap, why are you selling it to people, you know?
And I think about the problem also being like, yes, that she is knowingly writing stuff that like by her own judgment isn't good. But also, like, the publishing world and the publishing gatekeepers who are deciding to let this work through the gates and to, like, push that and market that. Something I've been thinking about recently is that, like, yes, we can talk about, like, if something bad becomes popular, we can think about, like, what this says about the artist. We can think about what it says of us. But we can also think about, like, what it says of the industry that has, like, chosen to prioritize it.
Which is what Watts attacks, like, a lot in this, in this review. She's very frustrated with the establishment and, like, the editors and the publishers who... They're trying to capitalize on a trend, right? And they know this is going to sell because it's, like, what she calls populist. Because it's for the masses. They know it has mass appeal. And she's basically being like, I know you don't think this is good. You know, which is... Yeah. Interesting. Maybe they do. And like, you know, a lot of people do really like Holly McNish's work. I'm not here to judge them. Like, I think that's great. I think it's lovely that she does that. She seems like a really nice person. Like, it has nothing to do with that. But it is kind of like, I would understand being like a poet who also writes poetry, has really like thought and crafted out these things that by virtue of having taken so much time to write them, don't have mass appeal. And how frustrating that must be just within this art form that is suffering. Like, poetry suffering as an art form right now. I would understand being frustrated. Do you think there's something, and we've kind of gotten into this, but do you think there's something specific to poetry as an art form that makes it so easy for these kinds of, like, debates to happen?
Well, because I think a lot of poetry is about being broken down, it's about being interpreted, and it's about being subjective. And so, of course, when it comes down to personal taste, it's going to feel a bit less concrete. We're not as practiced at it. We're not practiced at it the way, like, everyone goes and sees movies and then talks about, like, whether or not they like the movie and, like, why did you like the movie? And maybe not everyone can talk about it in the most technical sense, but, like, we have somewhat of, like, an understanding of, like, why we like the things we like.
Well, yeah.
And the things we don't.
Even us drawing the comparison to movies in this, it's, like, they're not even a one-to-one comparison because poetry is so different. Part of me wonders if it's also, like, our English curriculum that just made people frustrated and angry with poetry in a way that, like, maybe it wouldn't have been taught differently.
Writing is, like, the art that I think I have the hardest time talking about sometimes and breaking down. We even had a debate about, like, the use of language in trying to figure out our tagline for the season. Mm-hmm. And I was frustrated because there was something I didn't like, and I had such a hard time articulating why I don't like it. And I'm like, I don't know if this is just personal judgment or, like, what. Like, when I write something and I'm like, oh, that's good, I can't necessarily tell myself why I think it's good. It's just like an innate style thing. Don't know. It's just, writing is hard.
Writing's hard. I know I'm quoting Watts a lot, but I just want to get her words across, like, clearly. She says something that I think really amplifies this point. She says, in other contexts, elitism is not considered an evil in itself. We frankly desire our doctors, hairdressers, plumbers, and sportspersons to be the best, to learn from precedent, work hard, hone their skills, and be better than we are at their chosen vocations. Even in the other arts, the line between amateur and professional is clearer than it is in poetry, which I think puts it really well, like this difficulty with the specific art form. So Holly McNish also defends Rupi's work in her response to Watts, and it's really nice. But the way she does so kind of brings to light some of the issues with Rupi's work, like, accidentally. She describes one of Rupi's poems, which I agree is quite nice. It's a poem that goes, "It is a blessing to be the color of earth. Do you know how often flowers confuse me for home?" Which I think is lovely. And Holly says she would happily print and hang that in her daughter's room to remind her to be proud of her skin tone. And then she remarks that Rupee's illustrations are lovely. The issue also comes up again that Holly's kind of scratching the surface of in that whole controversy with Naira Waheed, which I don't know if you heard about this, but she's a poet who also got famous on Tumblr and Instagram, who has accused Rupee Kaur of plagiarizing her work.
Oh.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a big aspect of Rupee's legacy, or like a big part of the debate. I don't really want to get into it fully in this episode. It's kind of hard to prove if Rupee actually did steal Waheed's poems, since like she's also said that Waheed is one of her inspirations for writing poetry. But the biggest similarity between them and like what Waheed helped to popularize but has had a lot less success financially for is the style of poetry. Mm-hmm. So in the next article by Soraya Roberts, which I was obsessed with, I was like snapping my fingers the whole time. It's also pretty scathing, but a bit less like out of pocket. Robert says that Rupee Kaur and others like her can be classified as insta-poets, which is something you were touching on at the beginning of the episode. Can you imagine what it is about their, like, style of poetry that would make her say that? Like, how do you think a medium of Instagram would impact the written word in that way?
Well, like, we have pretty short attention spans on Instagram, so you're scrolling through, like, you're gonna read something that is like short and concise, something that is aesthetically pleasing, which I think might be part of the reasons for why she like spaces up her poems. They just like look cool, and then she adds a little illustrations. They're simple ideas. Like, I don't know, it's like an elevated live laugh love meme. Yeah. And it's just in a sense in that you're just trying to kind of like say something nice. I don't know.
It's like kind of if you're scrolling and it's like a fleeting thing that you're seeing, you'll stop and you'll allow yourself, again with the time thing, yeah, you'll allow yourself like 2 seconds to read it. You got it. You're done. You know
well,
what I mean?
Yeah, it's like the length of a tweet.
Yeah, you'll get it immediately. Like, again, with the like obscuring stuff, like the nothing's obscured. You'll get it immediately. You won't be frustrated. You're done.
You can scroll on someone's like personal profile, like feed, and like read it in like
yeah,
the scrolling.
And know? It's, yeah, it's short form, like you're saying, to be fit in this like square format. Holly will post her poems in front of this very bright colored background to get, you know, the attention of someone scrolling, like all of this stuff, which is totally understandable. Robert says that the reader is dead, which to me, she's kind of saying that like readers have now become viewers, and that these types of poems are kind of meant for instant gratification. She even actually quotes Rupee's publisher, who says that Rupee's poetry reflects our current age, where short form communication is something people find easier to digest or connect with. Which is like, okay, well, you said it a lot.
We have no attention span.
Exactly.
Do you remember when they tried to blame SpongeBob SquarePants for kids having short attention spans? And it's like, babe, just you wait.
Oh, yes. Just you wait. Back to what I said about how Rupee's like purporting to refuse a gaze and like reject the establishment, but she's actually kind of doing the opposite.
Yeah.
What Roberts attacks in her piece is that Rupee's poetry is designed for mass appeal. And because of this, she says, this is the poetry of capitalism. And then she makes a really hard distinction here where she says, this is not art, it is marketing. And I wanted to ask you what you thought of this binary. Like, can a written work be made with the express intent of getting likes and still be seen as art?
Well, I mean, all popular art is made with the aspirations of some kind
totally.
Of, like, response from the masses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least she's looking for likes and not money on an Instagram post, although like obviously she's selling books. But like, I don't think that something is necessarily not art because it's made for mass consumption, but I think the mass consumption dilutes perhaps the potential of the art. I think even God, sorry to bring her up again, but
oh no, I'm gonna get the jar out.
Yeah, just even thinking about Taylor Swift, who ironically put out an album.
This is the third time this episode, I think.
I know, but I'm thinking about her. Yeah. I've just been thinking about her right now because she's put out this album where the whole, it actually feels very 2014 aesthetically. And it's the tortured poets department, and she's writing in a way that she thinks is like more poetic, but in this really Rupee Kaur way where it's like, I'm just kind of saying things. I'm just stating things. Not like things are very like laid out for you as a reader. But because I'm just like, it feels a little less edited, it's good. And I think in her mind, like that's what makes it poetic, which is feels very juvenile to me.
Like stream of consciousness. Yeah. Does not a poet make necessarily.
Yeah. But I think the mass success of her work, I mean, she just like released another special edition of the album so that Charlie XCX couldn't get the number one spot for Brat, even though it's the summer of Brat. I think that, like, her insane, like, surge to, like, beyond just, like, popularity, but to being monoculture has ruined the quality of her art, that she actually made her best work when she had the fewest, like, people paying attention to her.
Yeah.
And
when she was nerding out.
When she was nerding out, or she was, like, actually just, like, making it for the sake of expressing something. And I think once you're just, like, this is, I'm really convoluted way of saying that, like, money makes people, like, less.
Selling out.
Yeah, you sell out, you feel, like, less of a desire to make something for artistic merits. It's just money.
Totally.
If you know you can make money, like, Ruby Cora knows she's going to sell books. She could write anything.
Totally, totally. I think, yeah, for me, my favorite videos are the ones that I've made where I was making it because I wanted to and not because I needed, like, money. Sometimes that happens when you make a monthly video. You're like, oh, shoot, I need to make something that's going to, you know, get views. I'm not proud of that, and I don't really like what comes out of that feeling. Yeah, and I think a lot of it for me when I was writing this, I was like, what, like, even constitutes a poet? Like, anyone can just, like, write poetry in their bedroom. At what point does someone become a poet? Because I don't think it necessarily means being published makes you a poet. Like, I think that's a little bit too restrictive. So I asked Phoebe what she thought, because I thought it'd be really interesting to hear her point of view.
I don't know when somebody becomes a poet, because I don't know if I'm a poet yet. If that, like, I think also I maybe have attached a lot of, like, stuff to publishing. I haven't submitted for publication in years because I was so sort of, like, in my school brain. But I think someone's a poet when they read a lot of poetry. Like, I think that if, like, that would be my, like, when I feel the most like a poet is when I'm actively reading a lot of other poetry and I'm talking to it. Like, and if I feel like I'm in a community of other writers also, like, I think if you're relating to and engaging with writing, not in solitude, like, I, you know, like, that's what makes a poet. It doesn't necessarily have to be institutional. I love school. So I feel like for me, that is where I have felt most like a poet, but I know that's not a universal experience by any means.
Interesting. Yeah, there's, like, a community aspect to it. I feel the same way about being a writer. Like, I've been trying to edge writer into my bio sometimes, and it's like, I've only been published a couple times, but I'm also, I feel like I'm, there are times that I feel more like a writer than others, and, like, usually it's when I'm reading to get inspired, and then kind of writing from the heart, but also kind of, I think it's, balancing the reading a lot, the writing from the heart, the engaging with the formal elements as well, and, like, honing your craft.
I think if you're existing outside of, like, the confines of capitalism also, that makes you a poet, because it is, like, it's inherently, like, an anti-capitalist pursuit to say, like, I'm going to sit and, like, write about a tree. Like, that's an embarrassing pursuit. It, like, exists without, like, outside of, like, all industries. So, like, if you're doing that and actively resisting sort of, like, not to be like, oh, like, all poets are, like, radical, which I don't actually believe, but I think that if you're engaging with something radical, that makes you more of a poet. When I think about, like, other generations of poets, like, they're mostly rich white people. Like, there are not a ton, like, it's like, and those people didn't need to be actively working. Like, they had benefactors, and, like, yes, maybe there was more institutional support, but who those institutions supported were so few and far between. So it's interesting. It's like the art has always been for the wealth. I mean, that's not a crazy thing to say. It's like artists are historically, like, rich fucking people who have the luxury of time to sit on their ass and write poems and make paintings.
Yeah, I was just reading an essay about Wordsworth and his sister Dorothy Wordsworth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just talking about how he and his sister would just lounge about the countryside, and, like, so many of his poems are just about the countryside. And it's like, well, yes. I wonder what class bracket you belong to, you know?
I want to write a bunch of poems about fields. That's what I'm going to do, is I'm going to, yeah.
The meadow. Like,
the open field, baby.
One of the things Watts focuses on in her review, which is what drew, like, a lot of backlash to her, is that a major selling point of poets like Ruby Cora or Ocean Vuong, who I personally think is, like, extremely talented and whose work she doesn't actually critique in this article, she just brings him up, is their marginalized identities. And Watts says that this makes them critic proof. But I think what, like, she's missing from the assertion that they're, like, intentionally using their marginalized identities to be critic proof is that, like, marginalized people are forced into these boxes to be able to succeed. Like, they're also, you know, engaging with a demand for people to kind of play up their identities in order to sell books. So it's not necessarily their fault, obviously. I think that what Ruby's critics fail to critically engage with is the fact that Instagram forces us to brand ourselves in order to like promote and sell our work. Like, I do think it's kind of more about the state of the industry more than the artist. It made me think a lot about the mini-sode we did about the literary It Girl. And I wonder how much of this is like Ruby and Holly and like the other poets simply being like beholden to this self-branding economy that like any artist kind of is. How much of this do you think is like having to do this to survive in this current state of art for these specific poets?
If you want to be an artist, you have to know how to brand yourself on social media. If you're an artist of a marginalized identity, then you have to figure out a way to make that work for yourself rather than, you know, how it has historically within these industries like worked against you, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, I think it's very hard to operate in a sort of medium space where you're like acknowledging your identity and perhaps sometimes bringing it up, but like not making that the basis of your work. Yeah.
It's so hard not to market yourself. Kind of the reason I don't have like a business Instagram versus like a personal Instagram. And like part of me also kind of likes conflating the two, but it's also a really dangerous conflation. But like so much of like getting work or getting paid work is this aspect of the self that is impossible to kind of extricate from it because we're like, we have these like mini brands of ourselves online. On the other side, there's like this academic article by this scholar named Maria Manning who says that the web 2.0 has led to a participatory culture where like users and audiences are encouraged to produce culture themselves. And I really think the internet has kind of created this confluence of like art and artist and like audience and creator. Like Rupi is kind of a fusion of being like, oh, a fan of Naira Waheed, and then being a fan who then writes poems herself, and then within like the same platform getting famous. And it's like this organic growth. I just think there's a tension between those two things. I just think it's like a really specific existence as an artist on social media from what I've gotten from this. Again, Ruby's like a very divisive figure. There are people who think she's like revolutionized the art of poetry and like updated it for a new generation. And there are people who think she's like destroyed the art form altogether. And then there are a whole bunch of people in the middle who see Ruby's work as like a necessary entry point for people who hadn't been into poetry before, but may have had their interest piqued by stumbling upon like one of her poems online. Like it's kind of like gateway poetry. Here's Phoebe. Is there any credence to the argument that Insta poetry is like a good entry point for people who are just getting into poetry? Like, is it saving poetry?
I make this comparison a lot, but it's anyone with a phone is now a photographer and anyone with a phone is now a poet. So I think maybe someone who like enjoys taking photos on their phone and like that's their primary access point, then it's like, actually, like I want to get into like 35 millimeter and like I want to learn how to develop my own like, and that is the thing that like makes those steps happen for themselves. Like that's inherently an exciting thing. Like that kind of accessibility I think shouldn't be completely taken down in one way or another. First time I encountered Sylvia Plath was like a photo from like the Bell Jar or so, you were like, I don't know, like, you know, like some sort of like aestheticized version of a thing that I've now pursued really seriously. Like, yeah, it was like, yeah, it was looking at an aestheticized version online of a thing that now is my whole life. And that was my entry point. So it seems silly to sit here like over 10 years later and then demolish that, because I think access, like whatever your access point is, that's a good thing. But I don't want the access point to now be the apex of the art form.
I just think that the people who are working in that field who are never going to experience the commercial success of Ruby Core because either like their work isn't accessible enough or because they're not like choosing to play the game of commercialized work have a right to be frustrated, because if you are a poet in 2024 by profession, like you are dedicating yourself to a life that is probably very fucking frustrating, probably not very lucrative, and yeah, you are in it for the love of the game.
There are parts of the interview with Phoebe that I didn't get to include for the sake of time, but she goes into like even just within academia, all of her like favorite poets who are teaching are like, do not get into this, choose any other field, because it's like, it's just dying. Like there's no, and like of course it was always difficult because it's an art form, art has never been able to be like that lucrative, but poetry especially is in like crisis mode right now. So it's, yeah, it was sad to hear, because I think poetry is such a powerful and like gorgeous art form. I love it a lot, and it really powered me through a lot of middle school and high school. Like it was so healing for me like at that age. I want to get back into it as an adult, obviously.
Do it, girl. Slam poetry.
And like, this is when I figured out for myself why I have trouble with her work. I was listening to this interview with this rapper, Mos Def. I don't know if you've listened to him. He's awesome, very iconic. But it was this interview on The Cutting Room Floor, which is that fashion podcast that we talked about in the Man Repeller episode. And he's talking about the fact that he thinks like Drake is more or less a pop star rather than a rapper, and that his music is made to be listened to while you're shopping. And in the same interview, Mos Def starts talking about like Palestine, and just from the way he's like candidly forming his words on the spot, you just get a sense that this is a man who is like innately talented. He is a poet. He's a master of his craft. And it's the same way, like, you know, most people would argue that there's zero competition between Drake and Kendrick on like a technical basis, right? When it comes to their art form. So when it comes to the elitism argument, the poetry community has for so long looked down upon rap as an art form, for example. Yet within rap, we can still very much discern who is like an artful rapper and who is a commercial rapper. And I think to me, that's the distinction we should start applying to Rupee Kaur without like denigrating her work, without calling people stupid for liking it. Still being able to be like, okay, yes, but there's like a distinction between her and like other poets who maybe aren't getting that much success financially, right?
Well, yeah, like I want to hear Drake at a party, but like there's a reason why Kendrick has a Pulitzer and Drake doesn't.
To Pimp a Butterfly is so good.
Well, he that didn't win the Pulitzer,
but, oh, but it's so good. I just think the issue that like, and this is something that you were just talking about, right? While it's great that more and more people are like engaging with Instagram poetry, the way Rupee's like so easily parodied, I think just speaks to a larger issue with what art is forced to become to succeed on the internet. It's not that like Rupee herself is necessarily bad, but her popularity suggests more than just like a resonance with readers. Like it also suggests what kind of poetry does appeal to us in this current time and what doesn't. And I think that's something that we should be thinking about and being critical of. Like, why is this specific style of poetry so popular? Why does this sell? What does that mean? Roberts actually says at one point, online, our taste is not formed, it is dictated, which kind of speaks to this concept of like manufactured consent. I just want to end off with a thought. Is Rupee's work truly like good, or is it just ubiquitous? And I'll end off with Phoebe.
I think Rupee Kaur is interesting because she is also an interdisciplinary artist. Like, I do find that to be interesting. Like, I think she's engaging with illustration. She's doing something that I don't do. I don't think about my work in that way. I will say she seems to have an artistic practice, and I do respect that. Just because I don't like it, it's still a practice. And I also like that she said no to going to the White House on Palestine. So I was like, liked that about her. I was like, okay, like, at least you're doing something I like with your platform. Politics.
Yeah, I like her politics most of the time. And I think, and there are some poems of hers that I am like, I like that. Phoebe, are there any poets that you're influenced by or would recommend to our audience to read?
I was trying to think about this question because I wanted to think about people who I find to be particularly accessible, because we want to talk about like accessibility in poetry, and that poetry isn't necessarily this like daunting, dense sort of like, you know, abstract, like, you know, this like deep thing that's like veiled by, you know, some culty like class institution. I'm trying to think about writers who I find to like really grab me. Like, I think Tommy Pico is one of those writers, and he engages with a lot of like contemporary language, and he writes about the indigenous experience, but also he writes for film and TV as well. So I think there's like the way that he engages with language, you feel familiar with it if you're not a poet to some degree, because it's a, like a language that's more shared. Like a weirder poet who I love is Kim Hi-soon, who's a South Korean poet who's translated by Donmi Choi. She has this like amazing line about like Marilyn Monroe and pig's blood, and it's like this very awesome like feminist graphic like riot girl, like she's just so cool. Atel Adan, who's also a painter who's from Lebanon, she has a long poem but short piece called To Be in a Time of War that's specifically about living in New York during like post 9/11 and the Iraq War starting, and I think it's very relevant for right now. I love her, and all of them have been like influential to me. Timmy Straw just came out with a book that I really like, and that's from Phonograph, like presses also that I like. I feel like it's important to mention small presses, because like something that a lot of these poets who we're talking about are doing, which I think they're actually existing in these like very old confines of the big six publishers, and I would much rather talk about independent presses who are publishing poetry right now. Like Song Cave, I think, is my favorite, then Phonograph Books, Ugly Duckling Press, New Directions, that's a little bit older and more established, but also an amazing independent press, Nightboat Books. I think looking for publishers that you really like is a great way to find poets you really love. I feel like there's so many poets I love. Yeah, and I love like the New York school, like the old like Frank O'Hara and Alice Notley and Ted Berrigan. Like I loved like the heavy hitter 50s, 60s, 70s. And that work is really like Frank O'Hara is super accessible. Like he like Lunch Poems is him writing during his lunch break. And there are these like really short, plain poems where he uses the names of his friends. And like, that's very accessible work.
So thank you so much, Phoebe, for coming on the podcast. If you want to promote your work, like where can people find it?
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a blast. I feel oddly starstruck, not from you, but just from the podcast, because I'm such a big fan.
Phoebe and I are friends in real life, I should say. Yes. So thank you.
I'm so excited to see you. I miss you being in New York City. But you can find me on I deleted Instagram off my phone because I felt like it was a time waster, but I still use it on my computer for professional reasons. You can follow me at bacon_fat, spelled with a PH and two T's. And I'm going to have a website soon. I've decided that this is my summer of becoming a public intellectual, and I'm going to start publishing more, and I'm going to my friend's going to take headshots of me. I'm becoming a professional woman, and look out, Holly McNish, because I'm coming for your spot.
Rehash is hosted by Hannah Rain and me, Maia. It's produced and edited by me, and the intro and outro song is produced by our talented friend, Ian Mills. Thanks for listening.